Hey there, this is Seth Juarez again with Channel 9 here with Rowan Miller. How are you doing, buddy?
Good, thanks for having me back.
Fantastic. So we talked a lot about in a previous episode of Eddie Framework 6 and some of the stuff that Eddie Framework was inspired by. And we felt it would be better to separate Eddie Framework 6 from Eddie Framework 7. Why is that?
Well, so Eddie Framework 6 is our current stable release. If you wanted to go and write an application today, EF6 is what you should use.
Right.
If you're interested in the future of EF and where we're headed, then Entity Framework 7 is something you might be interested in knowing about.
Right.
Hence our session today. But EF7 at the moment, still pre-release, you would not use this to write an application today.
Right. And that's important. Don't be releasing stuff on it quite yet.
Yeah, and I think it's important for two reasons. One, it's not stable, so you're likely to hit big bugs. Two, you're going to be very disappointed because it's still pre-release. It's still messy. We're still working on things. There's stuff that's not implemented yet, and so it's not fully featured yet. It's not ready to write applications on.
So what was the inspiration for, because any framework it's the same, but it's different.
Yeah.
Why the difference?
Cool. So we have a series of things that we were trying to achieve with EF7. And so I thought we could kind of walk through what each of those is, and then we could talk at the end about what the implications of that is to shaping EF7
into
the release
it's
going to be. Okay. So the first thing we wanted to look at was new platforms. So historically, EF6 and previous releases could be used against the full .NET framework. This means I have .NET 4.5 or 4.5.1 running on my desktop or my server.
Mm-hmm.
That's great if you're writing console or WPF or WinForms or ASP.NET.
Anything with the full framework.
Yeah, absolutely.
And mind you, because we talked in the previous video that Eddie Framework 6 was a NuGet package,
yeah,
but it still relied on some of the stuff in the full framework.
Yeah, if you looked at the metadata for that NuGet package, it says I target .NET 4.5 and 4.5.1.
Got it.
Okay. Now, there's developers that write .NET code in other places. So some examples of that would be, these days I can write a Windows 8.1 application or Windows Phone 8.1. Or in newer technology, we have Windows 10 Universal Platform coming out. And so I can write .NET code for that. That's not the full .NET framework. That's .NET Core.
I see.
There's also developers that write .NET code on something other than Windows. So there's Mono running on OS X. You've probably also heard here at Microsoft, we have an effort underway to make the .NET Core run on Mac and Linux as well.
Right, and then there's Xamarin stuff as well.
Exactly, Xamarin Forms, yeah. And so we do want data access in those places, especially like a good scenario is I have some local data that I want to store on the phone. SQLite is an obvious choice to store data on a phone application.
Right.
It'd be great if I could use the data access technologies I'm used to. Mm-hmm. When I'm running in that.
Absolutely.
So our goal with EF7 is to make EF available wherever you write .NET code. Now, that doesn't mean that every provider is going to work everywhere.
Right.
So for example, at the moment, connecting to a remote SQL server from a Windows Phone application is not a scenario we're looking at. But storing local data in a local SQLite database on a Windows Phone stored universal application is a scenario we're looking at.
Obviously, there's implications. When you made a decision at when you're looking at Eddie Framework 6, you're saying, we want to support new platforms, that necessarily means that there had to be some kind of change.
Yeah, absolutely. EF6 uses a lot of APIs that do not exist in those places.
I see.
We also have SQL Server baked into the core of EF. It's in there, it's part of it, it's very difficult to tease out. And mm-hmm. so that means EF can only ever run in places where we can actually compile against that full set of APIs.
Got it. Okay. Any other things that inspired the changes?
Yeah, absolutely. So along with new platforms is the idea of targeting new data stores. So back when EF was first originated, most people were storing their data in relational databases.
Correct.
That was the thing to do. Nowadays, we're coming to the realization that not everything belongs in a relational database.
Mm-hmm.
Some things do. Some things make a lot of sense in a relational database. Other things make more sense in a document database or some other form of non-relational data store.
Right.
And so in EF7, we wanted to look at enabling some of the patterns from Entity Framework against other types of data stores.
I see.
Now, what we're not building is some magic abstraction that hides what type of data store you're targeting. Because that stuff looks great on stage,
yeah,
and then you start writing an app and it doesn't work, right?
I'm very skeptical of magic when it comes to software development.
Yeah. So there's actually no magic here. The API that you're actually going to code against and the APIs you call will be different when you target a different data store. But the core components that make sense across all data stores, like having a context that gives DB set properties to query and save data, having a context that represents a session, having the context that tracks changes to those objects and then hands them off to the provider to persist to the data store in whatever way makes the most sense.
I see. So once you've freed yourselves to explore new platforms, the obvious next thing is, well, there's got to be different ways of storing data too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so obviously there are some things that only make sense to a particular class of data store. So when I'm targeting a relational database, I want to say it maps to this table and this column.
Right.
And so those APIs come in when you target, usually as an extension methods, they come in when you target a relational provider.
Right.
Another example would be when I target Azure Table Storage, I want to configure the row key and partition key.
Of course.
And so that API lights up when I install the Entity Framework Azure Table Storage provider.
So there's different providers that you can make your own provider.
Absolutely.
To your brand new whatever thingy you have, you store stuff.
Yeah, so some of the examples we've played with, and I want to make something very clear here. For the first stable release, we are most focused on delivering good relational providers.
Got it.
We are trying to architect EF in the way, by prototyping and doing proof of concept, in a way that it can be used to add non-relational providers, but it's very unlikely we will RTM any of those at the same time that we RTM the first release.
You want to sort of bake the core really well first.
Exactly, and we are effectively an ORM, that's our history, and we don't want to degrade the relational story at the expense of going after.
And look, I'm a database purist. I used to be a TA and I used to teach relational theory. There are certain things in data that need to be in databases. There's other things that don't. If anyone's ever like, everything needs to go here, everything needs to go here, I'm always skeptical. That's my bit flips a little bit when anyone's so dogmatic about how to store data.
Absolutely, and I think there's another good point there. EF is not trying to be the data access stack that you use for everything.
Right.
Developers need tools in their tool belts. We want to make EF a good tool that's useful where it's useful.
Fantastic.
Obviously, relational databases, though there may be some cases where you need down to the metal perf, at which point it makes sense to step around EF.
Yeah.
Non-relational databases, most of those guys have .NET SDKs that you can use.
Right.
And we're not trying to replace those. We're not trying to tell you not to use those SDKs. If you like EF and if you want the EF experience over something like Azure Table Storage, then it's a tool in your tool belt that you can use if you want to.
Got it.
Yep.
Were there any other reasons, there's got to be a couple more reasons why you decided to make a change at EF7?
Yeah, absolutely. So the other one is we have a whole bunch of features that we want to implement. People have been asking for a long time. They have been historically very difficult to implement in Entity Framework. And so in a minute, we're going to talk about some of the more fundamental changes we're making in Entity Framework.
Right.
And they will allow us to introduce a whole bunch of new features. So some examples and the ability to batch on save changes. So at the moment, if I add three entities to my context and I call save changes, EF sends three insert statements to the database. That's not the case in EF7. In EF7, that's wrapped up into a single insert statement that says insert into blog, lists out the columns, says values, and then lists out the three set of values to insert.
Oh, interesting.
And it will, again, take care of doing the topological sort, and when you have to propagate primary keys that are generated by the database to your child objects, it kind of takes care of all that for
you. Okay. And these were not available in EF6?
That is correct, yeah.
And what made it hard to implement those things in EF6?
So EF6 is, bits of it are 20 years old.
Yeah.
And it was not implemented using the design patterns that we know about in software today.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, EF6 is, we like to think of it as a big bowl of spaghetti.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of things intertwined. Things aren't split out into concerns. It's very difficult to get in and actually change, especially when you want to make a fundamental change right throughout the stack. So another good example, one thing we support in EF7, which people really wanted in 6, we didn't support, is the idea of having alternate keys. So I might have a person which has a person ID, but they also have a social security number, which is a unique identifier. And I can have foreign key relationships that target the social security number. And so having the ability in EF to say, I have my primary key, but I also have another property which is unique, and you can use this to uniquely look up this entity.
I see.
That was very difficult to weave throughout that bowl of spaghetti in EF6. Now in 7, we're separating things out, so it's a lot easier to represent, and we can implement it from the start.
Now, software developers, we're familiar. When you work on a piece of code for a long time, we call it, I'm just going to say the term, we call it technical debt.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just something we have, and you came to a point in time where there were certain features that required so much interleaving that it was perhaps better to make a break?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, realistically, most software does this at some point. Most software has a major release that is a fundamental not a fundamental change, but it's a bit of a break from the past. And you know, that's not something that software developers and people planning software take lightly, because it incurs costs to their customers. But
well, and if you think about it, I mean, we're at a point in time in computing where fundamentally computing actual CPU cycles are happening more and more on devices that are, for us developers, non-traditional.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good example too, we kind of went through this phase where we had a lot of CPU usage. Like, servers weren't that expensive, and I had them on premise, and I would buy a server and I would rack it, and I could run my app, and if it used a few CPU cycles,
we're okay.
You know, we want a good perf, but it was okay. Now in the cloud, I pay for those CPU cycles that I use, and so it's almost like devices have got more and more capabilities of them, but I'm more interested in reducing CPU usage on my servers because I pay for that.
And not only that, you only have limited CPU usage on a device, for example, where we want to target as well with any framework.
Absolutely, too. And memory gets important on a device as well.
All right. Any other things that inspired you to make a break?
Yeah. So this one is kind of halfway in between. It's both something that inspired us to make a break, and it's also a nice benefit of the break. Mm-hmm. The core of EF, we mentioned, is kind of like a bowl of spaghetti. And so in EF7, we're talking about making it a lightweight and extensible core. So what this means is we break up the core into distinct chunks that are responsible for one thing.
I see.
So change tracking used to be baked right throughout the stack. It's now broken off into a change tracker API. The other thing we do is we make it extensible. So we say, this is our change tracker that we ship in the box. If you want to customize a bit of how that works, you can either derive from ours and override methods, or you can replace it with your own implementation of the change tracker.
I see. So instead of it being sort of this big monolithic type of thing, we're giving like little nuggets of stuff.
Yep.
This is where you start.
Yep.
And then you can use what we have, or you can inject what you want.
Yeah, now I wouldn't expect, most application developers aren't going to go and re-implement our change tracker to do what they want. Mm-hmm. What they might do is have a little bit of functionality somewhere in EF that doesn't do exactly what they want. And so they could find that component, override it, tweak one of the methods, and have it registered as their own.
Like, for example, I want to start logging during change tracking.
Exactly. Actually, logging is a really good example. And so EF is kind of baked around the idea of dependency injection, mm-hmm. which is I have a container where I get all my services from. And so EF, at its core, registers a whole bunch of services, but you have the opportunity to override them. And then providers get to start registering their own services, too.
I see.
And so by encouraging providers to do that, not only can you override stuff in EF, you can start to override stuff that your SQLite provider gave you or your Oracle provider gave you.
And I think it's important to make a distinction between writing like COTS type software or off-the-shelf software versus writing frameworks.
Yeah.
It's like a very different thing.
Oh, it is, yeah, for sure. We spend hours and hours talking about API design and how to factor our components to make them usable by developers. And it's really hard, right? Because EF has like 10 million downloads on NuGet.org. It's really difficult to write software that is useful to that or to keep that many people happy. I mean, obviously we make decisions. It's going to upset some of our users.
Got it. The spirit of Entity Framework 6, though, was clearly understood. How much of Entity Framework 6 is coming over to Entity Framework 7?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Let's transition into what I like to say. EF7 is part V7. It's the next version of EF, but it's also part V1 in that it is, in a lot of cases, something new. If you're using the DB Context API and you're writing link queries and you're adding objects to DB sets and stuff, that all stays the same. Your code looks the same. Now, we have taken the opportunity to fix some unintuitive behavior we had in our APIs. For example, if you added a single blog object to the context, in EF6, EF would actually scan that object and say, hey, do you point to any posts? Can I reach any tags from you? And if I can reach those, I'm just going to assume they're added as well.
Okay.
That catches a lot of people out because they're like, I added my blog and now it's trying to insert 20 objects into my database. What happened?
I see. And so when you mean posts, you're talking about the actual blog sort of model.
The domain model, yeah, absolutely. So in EF7, we're trying to be more explicit about that. We have two APIs. One will add a single object. One is used for tracking a graph.
I see. So instead of, you've separated out methods just to make it clearer.
Yeah.
And so the old code from Entity Framework 6 looks exactly the same, but if you'd like to be even more explicit in Entity Framework 7, you use a different method.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some cases where we're breaking. So that add thing is something we're talking about at the moment. At the moment in EF7, add just adds a single object, and there's a track graph method, which you give it the root and it will go through and scan the graph and find it. And then you have a little lambda where you can say, this is how to work out the state of each object you find.
I see.
Now, what we're discussing is add is the ideal name for that method, because in .NET, every other collection type, when you call add, it adds the single thing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we also, well, not unfortunately, but we're in the reality where we also have the history of EF, and people are used to add doing something. And so we're talking about, do we actually call it add, or do we call it something like add single object or something better?
I see.
So we're trying, we're keeping things the same unless there's a compelling reason to change them.
And like you said, any framework 7 is open source. People can make comments about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Or try it out. We have betas out at the moment. I would encourage folks, if you want to try out a beta, beta 6, which will be coming out shortly after we publish these videos, would actually be a really good release to start trying out. The other ones are kind of very early releases, and there's a lot of stuff missing that will probably frustrate you if you try it.
So is there anything else you want to tell developers about Entity Framework 7?
So a couple of important things, and we mentioned this when we were talking about EF6 before. EF6 is still under development. Both were accepting contributions, but our team is also still actively developing EF6. We're not telling folks to upgrade to EF7 at this stage, and definitely not now because it's still pre-release.
Right.
And even when we have the first stable release of EF7, using EF6 is still a perfectly valid, perfectly supported scenario for some time to come.
Particularly if you're targeting the full .NET framework, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You would need to be targeting the full .NET framework. And I think the other areas, it's less of an issue because it's not really a break. We didn't have EF there before. If you want to use it, use EF7. What I don't want folks to feel like is if you have an existing app that uses EF6 and works, we are not going to push you to move that to EF7.
Well, and primarily because you're still working on EF6.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that there are some features from EF6 that are either not yet in EF7 or will never be in EF7.
Is there examples of those?
Yeah, so something that's not there yet would be store procedure mapping. Mm-hmm. We know that's super important to folks, and so there's a lot of people that won't be able to use EF7 until it supports mapping to store procedures.
And that's something you're planning on adding?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's kind of just below that line for what we can deliver in the initial release. Not because it's less important, just because we have so much time and we have so many people,
right,
and things have to be implemented in a certain order.
Got it.
And so I think there's a point at which EF7 will be stable, but it's not necessarily the recommended version to use.
Got it.
EF6 will be that recommended version for some time.
Are there things in EF6 that are just not going to be in EF7?
Yeah. So an example of that would be in EF6, you could do a very complex mapping scenario. You could take an entity, and we support three different mapping patterns in EF6. We support TPH, TPC, and TPT, which is just different ways of laying out an inheritance hierarchy in a set of tables. In EF6, you could actually combine all three of those in one hierarchy.
So can you describe those? I don't think I've heard the acronyms before.
Table per hierarchy, or TPH, means I put all of the data in a single table, and I have a column that says,
I got it.
This is a customer, this is a VIP customer, this is a previous customer. Mm-hmm. TPT means each type in my hierarchy has a separate table, but those tables build on each other.
This is a way of handling polymorphism as you map back to the database.
Yeah, so the base class has a central table that has the properties that are common to all customers. I then have a VIP customer table, but that only holds the properties that are new for VIP customers.
Got it.
The other stuff is found by joining to that table. Mm-hmm. And TPC, which is table per class, or table per concrete class, means I have a separate table for every entity that has all of the columns in it. So if I want to find all my customers, I have to do a union of those tables.
Got it.
And so you used to be able to mix those throughout your hierarchy.
That doesn't feel like the right thing to do.
No, and that really complicates the code base and makes it very difficult to implement new features.
Right.
And so that is a scenario we're not going to support in EF7.
So it's either one or the other, or how is that going to work in EF7?
Yeah, it'll be one or the other. At the moment, the first thing we're focusing on is TPH. The main downside of TPH is that you tend to have sparse tables that have a lot of nulls in them.
Of course.
But it's usually very fast to query, and it's simple to insert and things like that. So TPH tends to give you the best perf. It uses a little bit of extra space in your database. So we're focusing on that first. TPT tends to have a lot of performance issues. We're not sure. We think we'll probably end up implementing it in EF7.
There's a lot of joins and stuff.
Just because people want it.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily a good pattern, so we're still kind of thinking about that one at this stage.
Is there anything else that's not moving forward to any framework?
Yeah, so we actually mentioned this in the other video too, our previous discussion about EF6. Code-based models is how everything is going to work in EF7. We're not going to have the mix of XML-based EDMX and code-based models. So at this stage, you can either define your model in code and then use migrations to apply it to the database, or you can point our new tool at a database and have a model created for you.
I see.
The new tool has a fun name too. It's reverse engineer, shortened to revenge.
So what was the reasoning for removing them?
We find that XML-based models, they sound compelling to start with, but they tend to break down very quickly, especially in team environments where folks are trying to merge a lot.
Wow.
Or even diff a model. You can imagine an XML file. If you have 100 entities, that's probably going to be several thousand lines of XML with changes scattered throughout it. And it also tends to be an exact copy of the changes that have been made in your class files that are generated.
So it's like a duplication of work. And not only that, but in the migrations as well, you're going to have sort of these diffs going on as well.
Yeah, and actually in EF6, we never supported migrations on XML-based format, just because really we were maintaining parallel model formats. So the stack was, bits of it would cross over. By the time you hit runtime, it's the same model. But pretty much everything below that was a separate stack. And that made it really difficult to add cross-cutting features.
Fantastic.
Now, I do want to be clear, and folks will always point this out, with the XML-based file format, there are ways to solve things like merging and diffing. Mm-hmm. We could split it up into multiple files. What we're basically left with is we find ourselves in a situation where we have these two formats. We either have to fix the XML one and keep the code one, or we have to pick one of the formats and move forward with it.
There's
value in just having one. And having a code-based format doesn't exclude having tooling on top of it.
I see. So a third-party vendor could create some kind of tooling to do the ORM map.
Or we've actually done some prototyping with a read-only view over the top of it. So I can say, show me what my model looks like, and we'll generate a boxes and lines diagram for
you. You know, they already have sort of the .cd, the class diagrams that do similar things anyway.
Yeah, so we did also look, or we've talked about extending that class diagram to add some extra information to it based on your entity framework model.
But currently the priority is we want this thing fully baked.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're doing at the moment, we basically have a set, there's a couple of features we still need to add, and then we're going to shore up what we've got and try and ship a stack that will work for a subset of customers.
Fantastic. Well, this is really good information. Anything else you want to add in parting?
I'm just going to pop the URLs up. So learning more about EF7, we have akams.com/about-EF7. That will get you started on EF7. And the project I've listed there is on GitHub as well.
Well, thanks so much. This is very clarifying. And it really helps for us to see why we're doing the things we're doing.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks so much for spending time with us. Thanks for watching. Thanks for being with us. We'll catch you next time. Take care.